You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners.
Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 52 for July 2017. This is a podcast by Ford about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed on today's show. We're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I also invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Dan Cole is currently serving with, the U.S. military, and he's currently in Australia, in Queensland. I did see one Instagram he posted with some recovery, which is kind of interesting. They did with some, I think it's a Humvee, and I know he's been driving some Mercedes military vehicles. So interesting.
And actually, this morning he posted one of a nice six-wheel Defender.
Oh, so I didn't see that.
That was pretty impressive.
They get all the cool toys down there.
They really do. Although he also showed a military transport vehicle down there, which seats, I think it was 12 to 16 personnel on the back, all in individual seated roll cages. Just on the back of the truck. So imagine driving through the outback like that. Probably a warm, dusty experience.
Each seat with its own individual roll cage. That just sounds like an automated ejection system waiting to happen.
Right.
like the ultimate in off-road bus. This person is at their destination, push the button, ping, launches them out.
Exactly.
Do they sit along the side?
I could make that happen.
Do they sit along the side, or do they sit normal?
It was sitting along the side, presumably so you could just skid to a halt and hop out, or, start firing before you even stop.
Deploy.
Yeah.
Thanks for your comments, follows, and likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. Special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. Visit patreon.com/centersteer for all those details and to make a monthly contribution. The show is now available on TunedIn, which is basically a broadcast radio service over the internet here in the United States. I know I use TunedIn for listening to my Sonos, but you can now use TunedIn to listen to the podcast, and we'll have a link on that on our webpage if you wish to connect with us through TunedIn or you want to listen through your Sonos. You can also now tell Alexa, play the Center Steer podcast. I wonder how many devices we just triggered. I think through the Tuned In that allowed Alexa to the Amazon Alexa service to link to the podcast. So you can now tell Alexa to play the Center Steer podcast or play the latest episode.
And you just did it again.
I think I did. I wonder how many things we can trigger.
This may be the last episode anybody listens to.
So does this mean we could control people's purchasing habits and things now? Is that what that means?
Alexa, send $100 to Jagspeed Motor Works, Latrobe, PA.
Alexa, buy a galvanized chassis. It could be just that easy, right?
Could be.
We've been talking for a while here, but I am your host, John Costage. Joining me from Western Pennsylvania, as he does via Skype this month, is Harold.
Hello.
Short and sweet.
Short and sweet. I know. It's the little things, right? And also joining us from Vermont.
I am Morgan.
Via Skype.
Pretty nice. Nice weather up here, and I have to say that have some interesting news. I am now fortunately back into a four-wheel drive vehicle, but it's not a Land Rover. Tough decision, but
it's not even British.
It's not even British. No, yeah,
but it does have holes in it.
It does.
It's for drainage.
Yeah. Well, actually, it doesn't drain too well out. the air conditioning was leaking due to a clogged condenser drain. And so now
it's trying to be British.
It's trying to be British. It's doing a good job, and it has an ignition issue, so it randomly likes to not start.
And what,
so that's always entertaining. When you think it's never going to start, it starts fine.
It's a Nissan Pathfinder, correct?
It is. It's a 93 Nissan Pathfinder, so it's the first generation of those, which are pretty unique. They're still body-on-frame design. I think they discontinued that design in 96. It actually has a limited-slip rear diff from the factory. Mine's a 5-speed manual, which it's really nice to be back into. It's independent front suspension, but it can actually be converted to solid front axle. And it's got some of the niceties, like I said, the leaking air conditioning and some of that fun stuff. But
now, is the Pathfinder of that vintage built on the hard body pickup truck?
Yeah, it's basically identical. So there's
that's what I thought.
Yeah, and interestingly, the hard body pickup was essentially the 350Z turned into a pickup truck. So
all right then,
and it was quite successful on this continent, so parts shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, so that's part of it. Well, the vehicle itself was a pretty good deal, and parts are pretty readily available, and yeah, so you know it'll get me by. And I was sort of upside down on the Disco too, so.
Well, that's how they are.
It's true. I was expecting that, but I was not expecting to have no place to work on it. So
you don't buy a Disco for the profit potential.
Not at all. No.
Well, not financial profit.
Yeah, you buy it for the fun, not the profit.
Yes, fun profit. Oh, well, welcome to off road. Do we have to change the podcast now, or are you going to be joining the 4x4 podcast? Is that what's happening?
You know, that's a good question.
Well, you still run seriousparts.com, do you not?
I do.
When he's not busy building his new site, nissanparts.com.
Yeah, exactly. And I still I haven't sold the Disco yet. That's still sitting outside for sale. But I am keeping my Series 3 to finish rebuilding. So
that's good.
Or to start rebuilding, as the case may be.
Yeah, I got to restart rebuilding. Really, is the
it's the getting started that's the hardest part. You know, you just got to get in there and get going on it.
Exactly.
Is it still like an hour away to go fix work on it?
It's actually about 2.5 hours away.
Oh, wow.
But part of the reason I bought the Disco was to bring the Series 3 back up to my area to work on it a little closer to home. So now I have a vehicle that can tow again. So I'll do that this fall and bring it up here, put it in storage where I can work on it.
Rent some shop space somewhere or something?
It'll probably be more like, well, I have a storage unit for a vehicle, so it'll be stored in there and I'll be taking parts, large parts, home and working on them there and then bringing them back and dropping them in. So not the easy way, but far better than driving 2.5 hours.
As many of you know, my continental overland trip, I plan to part in mid-August. Harold tells me as of Monday that he was confident the truck will be ready. And does that still hold true, Harold?
Yeah.
I can hear the confidence from here.
It was just ooze, didn't it? You could feel it.
Well, it's careful because we're going on public record here now. So.
And although there was some good...
I can be more confident off record, put it that way.
Okay, I like that. Well, there was some good news yesterday, though. This morning you posted that you fired the truck up for the first time?
This engine, of course, I have long history with this engine. It was previously in the meat wagon, so I had no issues of trust with it. But I did get it turning in this chassis, mostly just to assess exhaust noise and that sort of thing.
But still
trying to figure out how many mufflers I do or don't want to put on it.
So is it 200 TDI or
yes.
What is it? Yeah, nice.
It is a 200 TDI of the Disco flavor.
Gotcha.
which will make it mechanically identical to John's 109.
Right. Nice.
Yeah, so that's
well, John, when you learn to repair your own vehicles, you'll be able to share that knowledge between the two.
Indeed, indeed.
My reasoning was more to make it easier to learn how to drive if they're both the same.
That's a good point.
Yeah, good point too.
So there's one is still a Series 3 and one's a Defender.
Correct.
yes, indeed. But it's still progress. I mean, that shows progress. All the pieces were painted about a week and a half ago, and Harold picked all those up, and they are now at Harold's shop. So that's further progress being made. And I think we have some things out for powder coating, waiting for those to get back. But they're not critical to the rebuild.
And I saw you found your plates.
And yes, I found it's one of those things.
The missing license plate, yes. the epic search for the missing license plate.
Every week.
Which has covered multiple locations and multiple people. Because we weren't sure who had possession, me or John. And turns out it was John.
Like every week for the past 2 months, it's been, have you found the plate? Do you have the plate? I think I have the plate. Wait, I think I saw it. Where did it go? Where the plate was? It was in a box where I think I moved the box. I remember it being here. Hold on, let me check the back of the meat wagon, you know. So it was finally, when I found it, it was like, oh, yeah, I remember putting it there now. You know, it had been in a box of stuff that Harold gave me from the 110, things that I should have and hold on to. And then...
Yeah, for safekeeping.
For safekeeping. And it was,
so they don't get lost.
They didn't get lost. And I transferred those items from a box to a garbage bag because the box was old and crappy. And it stuck on a shelf in the closet with all my camping stuff. And so as I was getting ready for camping, I was like, there it is. As soon as I saw the bag, there we go. So we do have the plate. The plate is back. So we don't have to do anything weird and special and spooky and try to get one last minute. So I do plan to... Head northeast towards the New England and Halifax and Nova Scotia and all those wonderful places up in northern Canada initially, and then head towards the west and then head south and back east again. So that's the general plan. For those who may be listening for the first time, I'm coming around to your house to collect a drink, especially if you're in North America. Because that's what I told all my work colleagues. They're like, oh, you don't leave. I'm like, hey, I'm coming around. I'll be at your house. You owe me a drink.
So basically, you're going to drive till you see water and then turn left.
Yes, exactly.
And then drive till you see water and turn left.
Turn left. Right. Correct. Correct.
Mm-hmm. He's turning left. Oh, now he's turning left.
So, Morgan, I'll be I should be at your place very soon.
Perfect.
Yeah, indeed. And I will be posting from the road to the Instagram account for Center Steer Podcast, which is Center Steer Podcast, all run together on Instagram. I think that's going to be the primary place of information coming out of the trip.
Is that center spelled British or American?
That is spelled British.
Okay. Like it should be.
And just like it should be. It matches the podcast. And I will also be doing some podcasting from the road also in my head, and we'll see how this goes. Maybe once a week there'll be special podcasts. There may be guests. It may just be impressions of things happening or what's going on. I'm not sure yet. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to do something. Like maybe when I get to Morgan's abode, we can do a live podcast or something. Maybe we can do that.
Just don't podcast whilst driving.
Correct. Exactly, yes. Our guest this month is, once again, Martin Port, who's the art editor of Classic and Sport Car magazine. He attended the opening of Jag Land Rover's Classic Works facility about a month ago, and we talked to him about a couple weeks ago, and we will add that he's our guest this month then to talk about the opening of the Classics Works facility, which was... Pretty cool, pretty kick-ass. I think it's a good listen.
I wish I had gotten to attend, but I look forward to listening.
I would only add that I now hate him.
I think the word is jealousy. I think is what you're looking for.
Jealousy bordering
right
on hate. Yeah, jealousy bordering on hatred.
And now it's time for the news. First up in the news is our continuing following of Jaguar Land Rover sales. For June, they were very good, continue to be very good, especially in China. Their retail sales in China were up 65%. The UK was up 3.8%. Europe was up 3.7%. North America was up 3.2%. And then it says overseas markets were down 8.5%. I assume that's rest of world from the ones that we already read. That's not clear.
What's left?
Right. I guess Brazil, the Middle East, and Russia. Maybe that's what it looks like. Well. So, yeah. But sales are up. Things are good. Jaguar sales reached 15,343 vehicles in June, which is up 16% from the previous June, thanks to the F-Pace and the XF, which is the big Jaguar. Land Rover sales were 36,248 vehicles in June. That's up almost 9%. A month on month to year from the same month for them last year, based on strong demand for the new Discovery and Range Rover sales. I think that would also include the new Discovery Sport, right? Because that came out and that should now be hitting sales. So Discovery Sport should be doing very well, and I guess the flagship Range Rover, according to Land Rover, is doing very very well too, also in sales. And then starting this month, July. Our recording, the Velar is now making its way to showrooms, and so that those numbers will now be affected by that. Will affect sales.
And I assume that those showrooms are only European showrooms right now.
I don't think so, because we have a story coming up. As you know, they spotted a Velar on the road in New Jersey, which is close to Jaguar's, JLR's North America headquarters. So I think it's coming.
Which means maybe they're testing it, but they're not ready for distribution yet.
Yeah.
Right. I can't remember if they did some shots of the Velar out west for some marketing stuff. I know I've seen the Disco 5 out there in Moab and stuff.
Yeah, I don't think the Velar has... had seen any proper off-roading. I thought I did see maybe one picture of it in some mud, but I think that was back in the UK. Guess we should have done a little more research on the
proper English mud.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Mind you, if it's been spotted in this country and it's not wearing development camo, they probably are pretty close to having it in the dealers.
Right. Right. Okay.
Or they're just trying to see how much buzz it creates.
Yeah, I'm looking at that article now. It was this was on rangerovers.net. I guess it's a kind of a community forum, and it was just Velar was heading south on the Garden State Parkway, not too far from JLR HQ. The side looks very nice with flush handles as well as the interior with a large tablet like a center console. Even the front was nice. The back is another story. That was a comment posted. That was a comment posted on the on that forum.
Interesting. Well, you know, New Jersey, New York area is probably a good place to drive around the Velar to.
Well, isn't that not its intended
generate interest
in its intended customers? Really, it's. You know, it's an on-road vehicle. It's not really designed for off-roading. There's a review of it.
Now I see the natural habitat of that vehicle being the Hamptons.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and out in L.A.
Yeah. Oh yeah, D.C., Chicago, big cities. It's a beautiful looking car. It really is. I agree with the comments that especially from the front and the side, it's a beautiful looking vehicle. But it's based on what the Jag, is it the F-Pace, right? The F-Pace platform?
Yes, and the platform they don't need to have.
Sorry. Oh, you know, Harold, I wanted to save this for the podcast, especially about the F-Pace. So in my local neighborhood here, there is, Howard Hanna is a real estate agency. They sell they sell houses for, I'm not sure if a real estate agent is the same all around the world, but
they're actually a chain of realtors. There's multiple franchised offices. They're like a Century 21.
Correct. And their colors are green and yellow, very similar to kind of like Land Rover colors. And for years, the local one here right off of Route 30, they had a Freelander 2 in the livery of Howard Hanna. And just this week, driving by, Jaguar F-Pace is now the official car.
Yeah.
I just thought it was, okay. That was funny. Thought of you, you know. It's just
well, it might be a step up from a Freelander.
Yeah, yeah. Nice look. It was a little odd seeing it in that kind of British Racing green. Well, it's a little more olive, I think, than the proper British Racing green. But
there is no such thing. There is no such thing as proper British Racing green. Every manufacturer chooses their own shade of green, and it becomes their racing color.
I see. Oh, I didn't know that. So the Velar was reviewed by Autocar out of the UK, and so the mechanicals were kind of interesting, I thought. It is 4.8 meters long, and they describe it as more sport minus, as in Range Rover sport minus, than Evoque plus. All right, I guess we got to pause the podcast here to talk about this, because we did have one comment about the show where someone complained that is it me? Am I the one saying Evoque or Evoque wrong?
You are the one saying Evoque. The other 5.99 billion people on the planet say Evoque, including Land Rover in all of their TV commercials.
All right, I will try to say Evoque.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, my head will confuse it again.
Bad habits are hard to change.
They are. Evoque. I'll try to say Evoque.
It's obviously Jerry wanted to evoke a new emotion.
Oh, that'll help. That'll help. Evoque a new emotion. Okay, good. That'll help me. That'll help me. So the Velar, or is it Velar? Sorry. The Velar is 4.8 meters long. It is more sport minus than Evoque plus. Did I say it right?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, and the engine is longitudinal. It is an aluminum platform. And the same one used for the Jag XE, XF, and F-Pace, and instead of being a transverse mounted engine like they have in the Evoque.
It runs front to back like it should.
And it's, it's less off-road based than, I think, other Land Rovers, but it's more off-road based than the Jaguar that it is, sitting on top of, right? I guess, and is that a good way to put that? The body is 81% aluminum. There is some steel under the boot floor, which doesn't hurt the weight distribution towards the rear. I guess the tailgate is a composite to help maintain low center of gravity. There is some magnesium under the bonnet. It helps lighten the front end. The total combined...
So engine fire should be spectacular.
Yeah, I was going to say that's going to make that quite a show.
It does say some magnesium. It doesn't say all. It just says some magnesium.
Some is all it takes.
Yeah, it does not take much at all.
The claimed curb weight, barring the diesel, though, is less than 1,900 kilograms.
Less than 2 metric tons. That still makes it over 4,000 pounds.
Yeah, that's really heavy for such a heavily aluminum. Yeah, for a midsize, heavily aluminum.
The use of aluminum and composites, if they hadn't done that, how much would it weigh? About 7,500?
Yeah.
And it's a light-looking car, too. I mean, the way it's designed, it doesn't look heavy. So, does that make sense?
Looks are deceiving.
They are, aren't they? Very much so.
Yeah.
It also looks like it might go fast, but...
All models... have an option here for the 178 brake horsepower diesel, 237 brake horsepower diesel, the 296 brake horsepower V6 diesel, plus there's a 247 brake horsepower petrol, 296 brake horsepower petrol, 376 brake horsepower V6 petrol.
That's nice. What are the torque numbers?
With an 8-speed automatic gearbox, I'm not seeing torque numbers, at least. Yes.
Horsepower is so irrelevant.
Although, here's an interesting point, the towing capacity is significantly less than the big Range Rover. I think it's, 2,500 kilogram towing limit.
Well, that's because it weighs actually quite a bit less.
Well, it's not just that, it's all the aluminum.
Well, that's true, yeah.
You don't want to tear the chassis in half when you're pulling something.
Yeah, very true.
So that should be – but although I think that it might be enough to tow what folks are going to spend on that vehicle, what they want to tow. They're not towing.
It'll tow anything you own.
Yeah, exactly, right.
But I mean, that's 5,400 pounds.
Yeah,
it's 5,500, something like that.
That's significant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be
more than you ought to be towing with something that size anyway.
I suspect people with Velars are going to be towing boats, maybe horse trailer, seem right?
A single horse, maybe.
Yeah,
I was going to say.
Although usually if you can afford a vehicle like that, you've probably got a staff that can transport your horse for you.
Or you're going to drive the Velar while somebody drives a Dodge Ram pulling the horse or something.
Right. Yeah. Like I say, you've got someone to transport the horse for you, or you just drive from facility to facility where there are horses waiting for you.
Yep. But it's still not a bad towing capacity.
Yeah, for a mid-sized vehicle of that type, it's plenty.
I did find torque for the 296 brake horsepower, 4,000 RPM, 516 pound-feet of torque.
All right. There you go. That's a good number.
They claim 0 to 60 in 6.1 seconds, 44 miles per gallon economy, although isn't that different miles than American ones, I think?
Probably. It's not the miles, it's the gallons. An Imperial gallon is larger than an American gallon.
So there's the new Velar that's out there, and it's hitting the streets now. If you, as we always do with any new Land Rover or that comes out on the market, if you wish us here at the podcast to test drive it for you and take it out and test its limits, we are certainly happy to do that. Just give us a jingle. We'll work it out.
I will also offer free Italian tune-ups for anybody who purchases one.
That's right, Stan.
So one quick question on the Velar. So it's the F-Pace chassis that it's using, it's sort of a narrower vehicle. Is that correct? Than the standard Range Rover?
I think it's smaller in every dimension, isn't it?
Well, right,
because it's midsize, not full size.
We did this last month, didn't we? We should really check our information.
Re-listen to the previous shows. Recording.
Yeah.
Why break with tradition?
But I recall that I thought it was wider than the standard Range Rover. Am I wrong on that?
I can't remember.
I guess it could go either way.
There was some strange. I remember looking at the numbers that maybe it was one of the articles. Maybe could take a look at those while we're continuing to talk. I recall it being longer but wider. I think we commented on that being different. It was like kind of odd.
Yeah, there was something around that we discussed.
Yeah.
So what sets the Velar aside from the Range Rover Sport, aside from being, you know, minus Range Rover Sport, plus, or closer to minus than plus Evoque? Is it just the new interior design that Jerry has come up with that's sort of modern or more modern, very much more minimal and focused around, you know, a touchscreen interface instead of having lots of buttons and knobs?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think originally it was said that there was an opening between the Sport and the full-size Range Rover. There was some opening area in there in the market. I think that's true. I think you see that with BMW. BMW has their X5, the X6, which I think this kind of seems to compete with, I think, the X6, and where they have this kind of very sporty midsize SUV. That's at least in my mind. I think that BMW showed there was a market there, money to be made, and I think Land Rover's gone after that. Subsequent, it seems to me, maybe I again, who knows? What, you know, I don't know much, but I think this might be some sort of platform for some future Land Rover tech and ideas that they're using. It almost seems like it's Jerry's personal baby, you know, his own personal hobby to put this one out, because I suspect he had a hand in a lot of this, but it also seems to be potentially a platform for the technology that you were talking about of having a simple screen, almost like a Tesla. You know, Tesla just has a screen and there's minimal knobs. There's very few knobs in a Tesla, dials and things. It's all on the screen, and it seems almost Land Rover. This Velar looks very similar to that.
Maybe they're trying to go after Tesla a little bit and try to woo some people back to the joys of engine noise.
Well, in the other direction, I know they've mentioned that they're probably going to push electric more through the Jaguar line, and this is based on the same chassis as the F-Pace, so maybe they're expecting this to be the platform that they can bring electric into Land Rover beyond just hybrids and some of the larger vehicles.
Again, it goes with being a test bed. There's some discussion that Land Rover might now want to go after Bentley's Bentayga. You know, some of the things you see in this potentially could be used to kick up Land Rover's luxury level on a vehicle, and this might be a place to start with that. They use it as a test bed for upping their luxury level.
Yeah, it kind of almost seems like they're fishing, you know, to see if it would work to launch, you know, yet another family that would be above Range Rover.
Now, was the Evoque Jerry's first fully new design vehicle for Land Rover?
I believe so.
So this would be his second.
Oh, you mean that he handled all himself? I don't know that Jerry handled all himself, or it's just my feeling. This seems to be like a personal car for him. I mean, every time you hear about the car, his name's associated with it and around it. That wasn't the case for some of the previous updates to cars. Just seems like, yeah, I'm here. But he seems to have his fingers all over this one.
Yeah. It definitely got his paw prints on it.
And even some of the things I've read, I mean, when you read these articles and you see them, he's associated with all these and seems to know the details. He, you know, is intimately involved with them, so...
Yeah, it is a pet project, I think.
Yes, I do seem to think feels like a pet project. All right, so the Velar is out, at least the new Velar is out. Where it'll go, we'll continue to keep track of that. It's just speculations on our part, of course. Jag Land Rover has opened their Chinese engine plant. They have a joint venture with Chery Automobile, and they have expanded that. And now they're going to build engines in China, exclusively for the Chinese market, and so it'll produce. And they already are producing Range Rover Evoques and Discovery Sports there for the Chinese market, along with the Jaguar XFL, which is not a American Football League. Thank you very much. I was waiting on that one to use that. Yeah, there's a. There had been a...
Well, we'll see if this one lasts more than 6 months.
Yeah, the XFL.
Even Jesse Ventura couldn't save that venture.
No. And the all-new Jag E-Pace will be produced starting in 2018 in China. So I guess that's engines being produced there then will help with their production of future models.
And I also read in that article that those engines eventually will be used in various Chery models.
Not surprised. Yeah.
Which I guess means starting next year, those engines will be available at your local Harbor Freight.
Will you be able to get 20% off with a coupon?
It could be. It might exclude that, however, but we'll see.
Could you? Will you still be able to get a free flashlight?
Undoubtedly.
Probably.
Along with that, I had mentioned the E-Pace going to be produced in China. Also, Land Rover is going to start producing with Magna Steyr in Austria. I was reading this, and I can't remember which vehicle it's going to be. But these are the first time that... Jaguar and Land Rover vehicles will be manufactured completely outside of the UK. There's been knockdown kits in the past, but this is the first time that Jaguar Land Rover will produce vehicles outside of the UK. And yeah, Magna will also produce the firm's previously announced first electric model, the I-Pace, from 2018, although Jaguar Land Rover has said it wants to build low-emission vehicles in Britain if certain conditions are met. That's another interesting point.
That is, definitely.
What I really wish is that they could get Steyr to produce a reproduction 101.
Ooh.
since they are legendary for the Pinsgauer.
Yes, yes.
Which is badass among badass.
Oh, absolutely. That's what you should have gotten, Morgan, is a Pinsgauer.
Yeah, that's a real budget 4x4 vehicle.
Absolutely. Indeed. Why not?
No, that would have been fun.
And it makes the series truck appear fast by comparison.
Yeah.
Tiny engine and portal axles do not equal speed.
No, but
they do equal go anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Capability for sure.
They're great for hunting too, because if you need a deer stand, you can just drive right up the tree and put it there.
Just to clarify, Magna Steyr will build the E-Pace in Austria in late 2017, and will also make the all-electric I-Pace from 2018. In China, Chery, with a joint venture with JLR, will build Land Rovers. What's happened? Yeah, so I may have gotten those two confused on who was building what where. They will make, yeah, the Evoque and the Discovery Sport and that XFL, as I mentioned, which I guess is also a Jaguar. So, yeah, there we go. Well, I think the point of this is to show that Jaguar is now trying to be a global producer of vehicles. If they're trying to increase their numbers around the world, they're going to have to produce more, and it looks like they're unable or maybe I don't know about unwilling, but don't want to have everything produced in the UK. And
I think they might have learned something during their tenure with Ford and being part of a global company like Ford. And now that they're on their own, they have to make that happen for themselves.
Yep. I would agree.
Yeah. And I think also some of the more recent political issues happening with the UK have given them, you know, additional incentive. Well, UK and honestly US have tipped their hand a little bit to say, gotta diversify our sources here.
We mentioned earlier about the Bentayga and just a little more firm information about I guess maybe in this month's What Did Jerry Say segment, Jerry McGovern, Land Rover's design director, was just talked to, I think, in Spain. I think we talked about that last month, too. But this time, this was about the Bentayga, and his thinking was, and I'm looking for the exact quote, Jerry McGovern said last month at the Automotive News Europe Congress, why not? We've realized that the Range Rover has got this big expanse across its price range, so it's not a very big step to get into Bentayga country. He wants to expand the number of Land Rover models bearing the luxury Land Rover badge beyond the four it has now: Range Rover, Range Rover Evoque, Range Rover Sport, Range Rover Velar. He says, quote, I'd argue that you could have two Range Rovers exactly the same size, but if they had two personalities, then we'd have the equal appeal but to different customers. Which actually,
that's been his logic for a while. Why not? Right. Why not make them look the same? Why not make everything look alike? Why not make it look like a Ford? Why not?
But I think you might see that already in the full size Range Rover and the full size and the Velar, and they are not exactly the same vehicle, but they do look similar, and they have that family look to them. And Velar could easily be the one that maybe gets bumped up to compete with the Bentayga. It's a possibility. Or becomes
or Velar becomes a separate division, and the existing Velar becomes a Velar Sport, and then the full size Velar becomes the Bentley knockout.
Right.
Then certainly with the Range Rover in the past, they've had special edition models that crept up closer to what the Bentayga is for pricing.
Oh, yeah, you get the autobiography edition, right?
Yeah.
They have those they kit out. But I don't think those go anywhere near Bentayga prices. I think Bentayga starts at $230,000. I don't think you can get a Land Rover north of $200,000, at least here in
the US. I agree. Yeah.
You could have it kitted out, but I don't think you can buy a stock one for that.
Definitely not stock, but even when you move into the autobiography stuff, that's, I think, around, it doesn't go past 125 or maybe 150. That could be wrong. Final quote here is Jerry McGovern says, Bentley doesn't have the pedigree and authenticity in that particular sector. We've got unquestionable pedigree.
Yeah. Well, Bentley hasn't been relevant in my mind in the badass sector since they stopped putting gear-driven superchargers on the front of the vehicle.
So moving on from new Land Rovers to old Land Rovers, there is a tracked Land Rover Series 2 that is coming up for auction next month in September. That's one of the Cuthbertsons. I was trying to say that and just get a little off-tongue.
You got very close.
I did.
Yeah.
So this is a 1958 Series 2. Well, technically, it's a Series 2 body on top of the underpinnings for the track system. Small number, fewer than 20 were made, and they don't know how many still exist. Probably seen it. If you've ever seen the tracked Land Rover, Series 2. This is the one you've, I'm sure this is the one you've seen. It's in really good shape. It's gray. It looks like a 109 pickup. It's going to go at the...
Which is about the shortest wheelbase you could build with the Cuthbertson conversion on it, because you'd be hitting track against track if you tried to put it on an 88.
Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Let's see here. Cuthbertson developed a subframe to accommodate the tracks, then slapped on a Series 2 body on top of it. The driving those tracks are sprockets that have just about the same size as a conventional wheel. The off-roader was also fitted with a Husky crankshaft-driven power steering unit to make sure it would turn left and right.
Or at all.
It was not built to be fast with a top speed. Anybody take a guess on what the top speed was?
28.
Morgan? I know you've seen the article, but... Do you remember?
Yeah, I can't imagine it would be much more than 30.
And it's, you guys were both actually high. It was 20 miles per hour.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't want to. I mean, if you've seen how.
Downhill with a tailwind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Downhill being pulled, maybe.
I figured half the speed of one on tires.
Yeah, good estimate.
So this is going to go, as I said, up for auction at Bonhams at the Goodwood Revival. The auction house estimates it will fetch anywhere between 50,000 and 60,000 pounds, which is probably, what, $65,000 to $80,000?
Yeah, you know, if you had to build one, that it would cost you that much. So
yeah, right.
Buying one with a pedigree is probably a bargain.
Indeed.
Yeah, and especially here in the U.S. where, you know, buying just a Defender is going to cost you that much, and then, you know, slap a pair of Max Trax under it or something, and Matt Trax.
Yeah, you're talking 50,000 just in the tracks alone, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Plus, you got to know how to install them.
Yeah, it's, from what I've heard, not that bad, but still, it's a project.
Right.
And it's still probably going to have a top speed of about 20 miles an hour.
Moving on to a little bit of non-Land Rover news. There's no Land Rover content in this at all, but I just found it an interesting article. It has been a kind of a slow news month. So this was
very slow for resorting to non-Rover news.
Yeah. Whiskey-fueled car makes first journey. The world's first car running on biofuel made from whiskey residue has had its first successful drive. The fuel called biobutanol. Designed as a direct replacement for petrol and diesel, and does not need to have car engine does not need to be modified.
It is BS.
It's made from kernels of barley called draff and pot ale, a yeasty liquid left over from fermentation. This was done in Scotland.
Yeah, I think it's kind of BS and maybe a bit misleading, because people have been doing alcohol vehicles for decades and using residue and leftovers from other processes. I was doing that in college back in the 80s, so I know that it's been around a while. You know, the butanol aspect, I think, might be relatively new, because most of the alcohol work is done with methanol or ethanol, butanol being a little higher up on the carbon chain. It's four carbons instead of one or two.
The Edinburgh-based company recently received a £9 million government grant to build a commercial demonstrator plant, and that will be fully operational by 2019. Interesting.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, are we producing enough whiskey to make that?
Well, we need to start drinking up. Yeah. We need to start drinking. Drink up.
We might.
World's got an energy crisis. Drink up. Since we soon may be losing our Johnny K drinking game.
Oh, yes. I didn't even know we had a John drinking game.
Well, I really didn't want to publicize it too much, because as often as you mispronounced the name of the Evoque, I figured all of our listeners would die of liver failure. And there'd be no one left to listen to our podcast.
Except the one guy who didn't like to listen because he didn't like how I said it. He would still be around.
But he's not listening anymore, so he's gone too.
That's right. In some further there's a little bit Land Rover content. This has nothing to do with the vehicles, though. Although we do rag on Jerry McGovern quite often. He has been named, though, one of the 9 best-dressed businessmen of all time, up there with Ralph Lauren and other names I don't even know.
If Ralph wasn't on the list, it would be embarrassing, given that he's a men's fashion designer.
Indeed. Yeah. Paul Newman, looks like an Italian name that I'm not even going to try to pronounce.
You're referring to Agnelli?
Agnelli's on there, too. Yeah, he's on there. Gianni Agnelli. And then another gentleman here, Luca Cordero de Montezemolo.
Montezemolo?
One more time?
Montezemolo?
You have to say it that quickly, I guess. Yes.
Well, it's Italian. You have to say it fast.
Him, exactly. Yes, that gentleman.
Italians are all about the speed.
The man who saved Ferrari, Agnelli, right, appointed, say it, Montezemolo?
Montezemolo?
As president of the Prancing Horse. I just like it. That's wonderful. So Jerry was one of the nine best, according to the Gentleman's Journal, one of the nine best dressed businessmen of all time. And he turns
which qualifies him to direct design for Land Rover.
Well, he is a he went to the Royal College of Art, and he's also when he was a student, and he's now also a professor there.
Yeah, does he actually teach, or is that just an honorary title?
It is unclear. This is all a positive spin article. So that's the Land Rover news, official Land Rover news for the month. We're going to talk now about some events that have happened and talk about those. First one up is the Ottawa Valley Land Rover's 34th birthday party. This takes place 90 minutes north of the U.S. border in southeastern Ontario, Maberly.
In the Ottawa Valley, obviously.
In the Ottawa, Ottawa Valley, yes. And it's an event that I've been to a number of times, but it's been, maybe 10 years since I've been to a birthday party. And it takes place in the third weekend in June. We'll have a link in the show notes to Dave Bobek's article if you want to read about it. But it looks like a good time had by all. Looks like it was rainy, though. Wouldn't you know, the third photo right there, very prominent, is our friend Bill Fischel's Series 3.
Bill likes to go to that event. He's been many times.
He does. And the truck hasn't changed. Oh, no, it looks like he put a winch on the front. That looks new. I don't think I recall seeing that winch.
Yeah, actually, he took that truck completely apart and rebuilt it and took great effort to make sure it looked completely unchanged.
He did a nice job.
Yes, it looks as shitty as ever.
It has patina. Come on, Harold. There's patina here. There's heritage.
I can't fault Bill. Bill's a good guy. He does a good job.
He does. No, he does.
And he gets out there and does stuff, which is the important thing.
Oh, he does. Absolutely. Absolutely. And he has been for years, and he's a stalwart of going to these various events. He's been to, what's the one that takes place up in Newfoundland, the Winter Romp? He's been there a number of times.
That's only in Maine. That's on our side of the border.
Oh, is it? I thought there was one. Wasn't there an event up in Newfoundland?
Perhaps, but it ain't the Winter Romp.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Or the Maine Winter Romp, as
Maine
it's actually
Winter
known.
Winter Romp, right. There is something in Newfoundland that he attended years ago, and it was like a dozen people showed up, but it was apparently good time had by all. The birthday party is interesting. They have a bunch of trails. There are trails for new folks. There are some light off-road trails. There's some intermediate trails, and then there's, I guess, Bolton Creek Trail, which has a rather large stream crossing is central to the trail. And it says here, trying to avoid semi-obscured underwater boulders make this for an interesting exercise in navigation for the driver.
Oh, yeah. Please don't go there, John.
I'm not planning to. At least not
that's
that
trail. That's a long tow home.
not that trail. Not that trail. Yeah, I had the Freelander up there years ago.
You would find that stone, I guarantee
it. Most likely, yes. Well, Dave Carroll would find that. He'd find all of them, let's be clear.
But Dave would push them out of the way for everybody else. You would find it and break something. There's a difference.
For longer distance driving, there's another abandoned railroad, Kensington and Pembroke Railroad, and a trail. I guess you can take that for a little more. I guess green laning might be a better to do that. Better.
Well, it depends on whether they left the ties in place. That could be a real interesting harmonic suspension test.
And then there's a heavy off-road trail, a traditional exercise for the mud-bogging enthusiast. A winch and recovery gear are necessities. These trails all benefit running in a small group of vehicles. Added the number of trails over the years so they can have the smaller groups go out. And then I guess there's also the usual night runs, and then there's usual community food and evening activities also. So if you head on over to the birthday party and the third weekend in June, good time had by all. My recollection of the birthday party, at least one of them, is lots of mosquitoes. That's why I now pack bug repellent in my vehicles, because of that event.
Also known as mosquito bait. In Minnesota, they learn that smell, and it's a lure. It doesn't repel anything. Just lets them know there are humans in the area.
I saw something recently that there is some study recently completed that there are people who attract mosquitoes based on, I can't remember what all the factors were, but so apparently it's true that there are people that their pheromones or whatever it is that they give off, and it was not blood. Like people, they thought it was the iron in the blood that attracted the mosquitoes. That was the one thing it said it was not, but I can't remember what the things were. Again, mosquitoes were not part of my podcast research. And then finally, I got to go to the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix this past couple weeks. There were a bunch of different events that took place, and I went up to the Pittsburgh Speedway, which is north of about an hour and a half north of Pittsburgh, and they have what they call the historic races there. And that's where this is unlike the Vintage Grand Prix proper races that I say proper, quote unquote, that take place on the city streets and they use vintage cars. This is vintage cars that race on an actual track. And actually, a friend of the show, Nigel, has, what is it, a Formula Ford. And they're the Formula cars, but they're like smaller, I guess. What are they? 3/4 of the size, I think. He races.
Smaller. It's an open wheel car, much like the Formula Steps, but it's considered to be one of the first stepping stones on the ladder up to Formula One, and is historically was powered by Ford engines, and hence the name Formula Ford.
I did not know that. There you go. So yeah, Nigel raced their car number 17 and saw a bunch of other interesting vehicles going around the track. It was a lot of fun. There was an actual Ford GT there. There was Minis, the original Mini Coopers. There were Porsches, Morgan. There were Morgans too. I think there was a Morgan run around Morgan. I thought you'd appreciate that.
And did they have any of the three wheeled Morgans?
No, there were no three-wheeled vehicles at all.
Until one of the wheels falls off one of the other ones, then it becomes a three-wheeled Morgan.
There was a Volkswagen Beetle. I remember that. I did take a bunch of pictures and I posted those on my Flickr account. I guess I should link them, add them to the show notes here if you want to see all those. There's some video too of some of the cars going around the track. That was fun. And Harold, I think I've determined what our next project's going to be.
Yeehaw. Let me finish the existing one first.
I think we should get a...
And then you may want to finish paying for it before we talk about the next project.
I think we should race an old Jaguar through the Vintage Grand Prix.
All right. Well, that could be discussed.
You've got some Jags running around, so that could be fun.
Yeah, I'm not sure you'd want to put a four door saloon into the vintage races, but I mean, no. Yeah, why not? I guess
find something. Yeah,
they were the getaway car of choice for British bank robbers back in the day.
What are they doing now? They're just sitting there, collecting dust and
taunting me.
And taunting you. There we go.
Daring me to do something cool. I've been talking about getting one of my Jags on the road for a while, but then people keep breaking their Land Rovers and bringing them to me. And there's no time left to play with kitties.
Past weekend before was the normal British car day at the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, and there was a good showing of Land Rovers. I took the 109, and they finally have set up Series and Defenders in one group and then put the Discoveries and the Range Rovers in another group, so they were split up a little better than they had been in the past. We had Defender 90, my 109, and, of course, Dave's 109.
Dave's trophy collector?
Dave's trophy collector collected another trophy, yes.
Yeah, showed it up. He can tile his bathroom and all the trophies he's picked up with that truck.
That's right. It was a nice day. It was the usual hot, but it wasn't too humid, and there were a ton of vehicles out. Also, my friend Ashley, who has gone on the road rallies with me in the past in the 109, she was able to show up in her Volvo P1800E.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah. Yes, a Swedish-British car.
Swedish-British car, which Harold has worked on. And
because it's British. Why not? That's my rule. It has to be British. And actually, I mean, it's this one was made in Sweden, but I mean, everything about it, technically, it's a British car. You work on it like a British car. You drive it like a British car. It acts up the same way as a British car. And actually, the first year and a half of the production of the P1800 was made in England by Jensen.
Oh, interesting.
So it is literally a British car.
Aside from the B20 engine, but...
Hey, don't knock the B20. It's nothing wrong with it.
Oh, no. I'm just saying that that's you know, it's a good solid engine.
Yeah, it's a cast iron push rod non cross flow four cylinder.
Yep.
It's British.
True.
What's the E stand for in the 1800E? Is that a engine?
Injection.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Fuel injection.
Yeah, because I think she has the – I think the model she has is the first year for that, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, it's 19 – she has a 1970, and I believe that's
– Yes.
Yeah, her father bought the car new and – said that or no, I think he bought it used, not new. He bought it used.
Yeah, I think he's the second or third owner.
And he
was, I remember the story.
He was going to restore it once all his kids got out of college. And that unfortunately didn't happen. And now one of his kids did get to keep the car, and now she's trying to get it restored and keep it on the road.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice little car. It's in reasonably good shape. It's a good driver.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing a few things to it when I get the chance.
Right. Right.
There's a company in, I think, upstate New York called V Performance, who I don't think they make them anymore because I looked at them for a while, but they made some really nice superchargers for the B20 engine in the Amazons and the 1800s.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was fun.
And, of course, there was the usual huge amount of Triumphs and MGs and Jaguars and Aston Martin.
It would be embarrassing if there weren't a lot of Triumphs there, considering the British Car Day is hosted by the Western Pennsylvania Triumph Association.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Another good event. It was fun. Good time. A lot of people floating around. It's a free event, by the way. If you're in the Pittsburgh area, you like cars, it's a great event to come out to. It's free to walk around and see all the
cars. It's free to show up and look around. You know, if you want to, like, own something and bring it, it's not going to be free.
No, I think they charge, what, $30, I think, from the Triumph Association to...
I think it's 30 if you're able to plan ahead, but if you don't know which one's going to start that day, it's going to cost you 40.
Yes, indeed.
Still, that's pretty reasonable. I'm used to the various Stowe car shows are all, you know, $10 to get in, $60 to be on field or something like that.
To present your car.
Mind you, any of these fees are the least significant portion of your British car ownership experience.
Absolutely.
That's true. That's true. So, in fact, I did meet one couple had come up from D.C. just to go to the event and take pictures. So there are people that show up just for that. It's cool. Good event.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and the cars come out of the woodwork, too, from some distance, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that Series 2 that used to come from Ligonier has been sold because he didn't show up this year.
It sold a couple of years ago, and our associate Mark Love has done some work on it, and I've collaborated on some of that. So it's still around. It's just this guy isn't as social, you might say.
And there was a D90, a North American spec D90 for sale, very reasonably priced too. It was only like, I think he wanted like $40,000-$42,000 for it, and it's. Surprised it hasn't been snapped up.
Yeah, that's not quite as snap-worthy a price as if it was a North American 110 at that price. I mean, if 40 for a 90 isn't bad, but it's not like going to disappear today price.
And also at the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, two Jaguar and Land Rover related things. First, they have a dealer that brings all the new cars there, thankfully. And Harold and I saw the Disco Discovery Sport last year and got to sit in one. This year, there was the Jag XE was there, and also got to see the brand new Discovery 5. And this was a first edition model. First, talk about the Jag XE. Nice car, look good, clean on the inside. You know, it's nice. I had trouble getting in and out of the damn thing. It was tough to get in. I'm like, oh, this is unpleasant. I don't know if maybe the seat was raised too high. I mean, I did have to adjust the seat back to get in some, but maybe the lift on the seat was up too high, but I'd have to check that out. Unfortunately, it kind of dropped in my interest level because I couldn't get in and out of the car.
Well, you're sort of a full-size guy.
Yeah, I'd say.
Many respects, not just in stature, but in preference to vehicles, I think.
It's true.
So the XE is probably not enough car for you.
One of my considerations is how much will it fit in the vehicle. That's correct. And the boot was.
how many bodies in the trunk, for instance?
How many bodies? How many kegs? Exactly. I could probably maybe get a six-stool, but I'm not sure about a half barrel. I don't know if a half barrel would fit in the Jag. It was nice. The Discovery 5 was really nice. And this was a first edition, so it was all black. I recall it being about $78,000 American. It was interesting to see it in place. It had a very low center of gravity, you know, look-wise. I don't know if it was because it was all black or if it was just the way the body flares kind of at lower than the top.
Was the suspension aired down at that time?
Oh, it probably was in normal sit mode. That's a good question. But it did look kind of low. That's a good question. Maybe it didn't have to do with that. I don't know if it was being, again, in person versus seeing in just the pictures. Yeah, fit and finish was nice. The interior was nice. It wasn't there was a screen. Everything was black. I sat in the seats were nice. Those were certainly really nice. Front end. Drops off. It's kind of tough to tell where the front end was. The rear end was a little weird looking. I really am not a fan of the tailgate that goes all the way up. And then, it does have that little shelf that pulls down that you can sit on. And I don't know. It's not a fan of that, at least when it comes to Land Rovers and Discoveries. Even though I know the Disco 2's had the side opening door, but I think I like that split folding compared to what it seems like everybody's doing the overhead door. It was all automated, too, I think also because it was the first edition vehicle. Everything, you push buttons and the seats, the seats in front would go fold flat, and then the tailgate came down, and I think I manually pulled down that little shelf, but I think it probably was electrically controlled also.
That'll be fun to work on in a couple of years.
Yeah. Ain't that the truth?
Not so much fun to pay for.
Well, if you can afford $78,000 for that first edition, you probably are not too worried, I would think, about the repair situation there, though.
Well, not until the depreciation curve catches up with you and then you decide it's too expensive to fix, then it becomes the second owner's nightmare. That's usually when the gripes on service costs kick in.
Yeah.
Which, of course, makes it a bargain bonanza for the third owner, as long as he has a tolerance for little things being wrong.
All the things we've seen, especially about the Disco 5, everything we've seen so far, the Land Rover, clean lines and not a lot of bumps and knobs and dials, and there's none of that. It's all very clean on the inside. So we'll see how they do off-road in, 10 or 15 years, right?
Yeah.
Four or five.
So that is the Vintage Grand Prix, and that's I'm sure there are other events going on around the world. If you want to tell us about them, please do, and we can talk about them on the show, tell you about the events. There are other events coming up, and if you want to talk about those events, give us a shout out, and we'll maybe talk about your event and what's going on with it here on the podcast.
And before we close out, there's one other topic that came up recently on the LRO, the Land Rover Owners mailing list, regarding declining numbers in the Land Rover events communities, but also generally in communities. Sort of interesting discussion that I wanted to toss out there. I think some of the initial theories were obviously that these days with technology, it's a lot easier to get information about Land Rovers and fixes and make friends online via Facebook or Twitter or forums or whatever have you. And also that some of it is that, younger generations, they're not as car focused. They're not as into repairing their own vehicles. Maybe out of lack of necessity, along a number of years ago, cars were the primary way that kids got out of the house and went and hung out with friends. Now they don't have to do that. They can pull out their phones.
I think that's called showing their independence.
Yeah,
exercising
exactly.
Their independence.
And there are so many forms of entertainment now for everybody that it's hard to, have just one primary hobby. I'm sure there were other good reasons, but I want to talk
about. I think it may also have to do with, our generation. And what I mean by that is that, a lot of people in our generation picked up the hobby because their dads were into it. And so it was a father-son project, and it helped their dads on stuff. And if our generation isn't doing that as much with our kids, they're not picking up on that.
I'd also throw out that I completely agree with everything you guys have said. Cars at one point were the height of technology, and that was the and it was serviceable by by the normal folks and citizenry. Whereas computers have certainly, I think, taken over that spot. Generically, computers have taken over that spot as a something that's serviceable, usable by many people, and is ubiquitous and is out there. But it's also the cutting edge. It's the leading edge. It's the most interesting thing. And you even see cars doing that now. They're trying to become computers, really, with all the with the displays and the technology even. So, yes, my point of that is, connects with what you're saying, Harold, is that people would, you know, the families would do something together as father, son, daughter, son, a father would do something together because they were doing something interesting and kind of high technology. And I think cars have been replaced in many ways by technology, by computers, excuse me, in the technology area.
Well, and I think that also is part of the shift in the hobby in that a lot of, well, especially in our world, the series trucks especially are, it seems like they're even more popular with those who work 9 to 5 in the tech fields, and the series truck with its lack of technology represents an escapism, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in general with vehicles, the technology side, you know, has really complicated vehicles. It makes them hard to maintain and troubleshoot, and in many ways much more expensive to do so.
Perhaps even unnecessarily complicated them.
Right, exactly. I agree completely. So I think that has also had another factor of it, that they're not as consumer repairable or in many cases even diagnosable. So that takes a lot of the practicality out of it. So it no longer becomes something that you can just do at home.
That's true, because you do need, in that instance, specialized tools or a tool that you're only going to use, you know, specialized, you only need it once versus something that you can use across multiple number of places on the vehicle. That's an excellent point.
Yeah. Yeah, and
actually that phenomenon changes the industry as a whole too. I mean, it affects my business in particular. I can give my situation as an example. In order to stay relevant with some of the newer vehicles, I have to step up and buy more and more electronic equipment. And once I do that, I've got so much money invested in that stuff, I'm a slave to these newer vehicles. So it's easier for me to say I'm going to specialize in the older stuff, stuff without a computer on board, just simply because that's what I like doing, number one. But number two, I don't want to have to be a slave to doing tune-ups and maintenance on the modern stuff just to be able to pay for the equipment to do that work that I really don't want to do.
Yeah, and I think that has changed so much that even, I'll give Vermont as an example. We probably very much behind most states just switched over to a computerized annual inspection system so that every vehicle has to have their ODB2 system plugged into a computer, scanned, and all the data gets actually sent to the state. So that makes all of that much more trackable and much more stringent than it has been in the past, because there's no cutting corners. But that means that, you know, you have to have that equipment. It's more expensive for everybody. And honestly, it makes the vehicle much more of a chore for everybody involved and not so much a, oh, I just have to fix this one thing. Let's figure it out. Do it. That's
now,
kind
is
of
it,
an entertaining challenge.
Has it taken that long for the regulations, the inspection process and all that to hit Vermont because of resistance to federal regulations? Or is it maybe because the equipment manufacturers had to develop a diagnostic machine with a hand crank on the side?
I would lean towards the latter. But honestly, I think really it's mostly because Vermont is such a diverse state in terms of economics, and it's very much, you know, populations are only centered in a couple of areas. So
the rural is how I would describe it.
Yeah, it's definitely very rural, but it does have some pretty populous areas that border larger states, right? So it's not a particularly large state. And so the finances and honestly the technology, a lot of Vermont only until recently has gotten or has not had broadband internet. So it was hard to say, oh, every garage has to have a computer connected to a central internet connection, right?
Right.
So I think there was a lot of that. And also just that the state was sort of like, well, why do we need to computerize all of this? They still required that every computer or every car be plugged into a computer and scanned and had to not have any check engine lights or any failures within the last certain number of days or miles. But it was just much harder from a technology standpoint to create that solution for the entire state and make that a requirement.
When your shops have to plug that machine into an acoustic coupler bung to a payphone and keep dropping quarters in the slot.
Payphones, rotary phones.
with a coin slot on the side.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that. But again, I think that makes it, vehicles are no longer, let's just tune it up and do the maintenance. They've got all these other features that, you can't pass an inspection in Vermont if you have a bad tire pressure monitoring system. Oh, well, I could just put air in the tires, but no, I've got to pay a few hundred dollars to have a TPS system replaced. It's all such a pain now. It's not.
I wonder if this is I wonder if this has happened before. History is usually a guide to many things, and I suspect that this has occurred before where, the first cars were, there was a lot going on. You look at a Packard, just because I happened to see one recently, and you had to do several things. You didn't just give it fuel. You didn't just brake, or even use the choke. There were other, I don't even know what they are, to be candid. There were other things you had to monitor and check, even that the fuel was getting in and the fuel was clean because they had, fuel monitors inside the cabin. I say that like it sounds modern, but it wasn't.
No, it was a glass bowl on a filter, which was bolted to the dash right next to the lever that you had to pump to deliver said fuel.
Right. Nice. So I wonder, that era of technology, I'm sure there was, when we went to the, how many eras have there been of car tech, maybe three or four?
It's been 100 years since those days.
Right. But there are still waves of those things,
right.
Of those technologies. When that next wave came in and then did the same thing happen? I suspect that it did where it's really interesting, and the kids these days don't like the old cars, because technology does change. It does get better, and it is more comfortable. It is easier to use. All these things happen, and I wonder if we're going through maybe another one of those waves where we're moving to the next level where, yes, it's now the technology is the computer in the car versus the mechanical technology. My final thought on this, at least for the moment, look where this conversation started. and great people, I'm on the list, it's the series, basically series truck owners. And
These are guys who alternately lament the loss of the dial-up BBS.
Right, exactly, right. And,
true.
Exactly. I mean, this whole idea of subscribing to an email with all this stuff in it is far more high tech than they would prefer.
Yes, heaven forbid they move this over to a its own forum, let alone a Facebook page.
That will not happen.
And it will not happen, right. And I get it.
Those guys will fight to the death to prevent that.
I get it. And
someone will physically break the server with an axe before that happens.
And that also goes to show, or I guess allows me to make the point that that's accessibility. And by having that, you're almost like shutting people out and not making it accessible by saying, well, if you want to do this, come join us over here in this old method of doing things. It doesn't make it open to allow people to join. And that's fine if that's, that's fine. I get it. But it doesn't. But
your numbers will shrink if you don't make it inclusive to new people.
Thank you. You said it better than I did. I was going to say I felt in a wouldn't sound.
And that's been the problem of a number of the clubs too. If they don't actively recruit new members, they're going to shrink and eventually they will cease to exist.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the whole observation is that some of the mailing lists, they were previously a much more passive way of communicating with people, right? You don't have to go out to a forum and remember to check it. You don't have to remember to go to Facebook and check it. You just get the message sent to you. So, you know, I see where they like that aspect of it. And, you know, without going out and promoting it, you're not going to see many people coming into that forum. But clubs themselves are sort of similar, whereas it used to be that you to have camaraderie and support for your vehicle, you wanted to go out and find the local club. And then all you had to do was go to those meetups, and then you would have the discussions with people. And once you were there, it was much more passive. And you basically just had to do the one thing to go out and find the club and then attend the meetings.
So I think you have to do two things. You have to find the club, and then you have to actually get your truck to start so that you can go to the meetings.
You have to get a truck to start, or maybe call a friend.
Something, anything.
Yeah.
You have to get a functioning truck, yes.
So I think what you're saying...
so true. And then, you know, and then once you're there, then, you know, you go back and you have your ideas, and you do more to sort of fuel and maintain your own interest in that vehicle, right? Or just get the thing running.
Well, I think what you're getting after is the social aspect of it. You get together, you talk about your truck. You know, one of the things we do here on the podcast is, and that's what it's kind of about, the social aspect of it is community. And that the, you know, Facebook or forums even, you know, drew that community in a certain way, and email drives that community in a certain way. And if you want that community, you need to change and move and kind of go with it. Did I say that well?
Well, partially, but I think part of it is that there really have become so many different avenues to get the information, right? Mm-hmm. It's been fractured so much, right? That originally there were a few mailing lists out there, a few BBSs, then there were some forums, and then there was social media. All of that has sort of exponentially increased in options, right?
Yeah, I think we could say that social media is starting to kill the forums.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree. Yeah.
So it kind of all evolves.
But what's the function?
It's an evolution and a fracturing, which makes it harder, you know, but it's everything in daily life now, right? It used to be that you had a phone and a mailbox at your home. Now you have a phone, a mailbox, you know, internet, TV, radio,
get off my lawn,
devices, all your social media. Yeah, you know, it's really just that there are so many more options for everything. That everybody's time is fractured. Everybody's options and communications methods are fractured.
But I think maybe the greater point here is declining numbers. Maybe, and that's, I just thought of this one, it's declining numbers in a certain way, in a certain location. You know, it's the email threads that are declining in numbers, and maybe in the clubs themselves, because that social aspect of information sharing and the socialization was what the clubs, and also I think that email list brought, has been replaced by newer technology, by forums, and by, say, Facebook in particular. Currently, they've replaced those things. They've taken over the function of socialization and of information sharing.
Well, yeah, I think it's much easier to log into Facebook and get your social interaction with your rover-loving friends there, as opposed to actually leaving, going out and going somewhere and showing up for something.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And it's even easier to get your enjoyment of your favorite mark or any hobby, really, without even walking out into the garage and, you know, bloodying your knuckles trying to get something fixed once and for all, right?
Well, I call that going to work, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but not all of us have that pleasure, right?
I guess you could use that adjective.
So, yeah, I think it's that, you know, the socialization has been replaced, the, you know, needing to find parts or find how to fix something, that's been replaced. You don't have to go and ask.
Yeah, I hear there's websites you can go to and specifically search for.
So true.
So, but let's wrap this. Let's wrap this up. What's your? What do you think is? So, what do we think is contributing to the declining numbers? And is there? Are they really declining? Maybe they're not.
Maybe we need our listeners to chime in and tell us.
Yeah, I think we definitely want to hear from our listeners as to what whether they see numbers declining, whether they see,
where
generally
are the
declining numbers in
where and how?
Land Rover.
You can't just say declining numbers because I don't think there's declining numbers in interest generally in, say, Land Rovers. I don't think that's the case. Specifically, are they declining for, say, older heritage trucks that are people who are going to use and work on them? Yes, I think that's the case. I also think there's declining numbers in interest in person and in the older technology, if I can say that, such as email lists. I think definitely I think that's the case.
Let's call it legacy communication methods.
Yeah. Now I'm at work.
And I think we have a lot more and more frequent turnover of those legacy technologies. But I also see an increase in interest in especially retro four-wheel drive vehicles in the U.S. and Europe as well, among some of the, I don't know if they're technically millennial generation or on the cusp of it, but there's a large number of younger generation who are interested in classic four-wheel drive vehicles.
Like I said earlier, it's an escapism. They can escape their daily job of dealing with computer technology and go work on something that doesn't require it.
Right, exactly. So, I think that there's probably not overall a decline in interest, but I think there's decline in the number of members in any social group, whether it's mailing lists or, in-person clubs or forums or, Facebook may be rising right now, but it's going to probably fall off to whatever comes next.
To add to your earlier comment, you kept using the word fracturing, and my word for that would be dilution. I think there's so many more choices now that it's diluted the pool, if you will, of available information.
Absolutely, yeah. And then there's also the pool of information, but also of people's interests, right? So they may have far more hobbies now than people did have a number of years ago. It's just so much easier to find new opportunities
for hobbies.
Yeah.
There's still only so many slots in the day that you can fill up, and I think opportunities for hobbies have certainly increased, though.
Yeah. And I think also that, as modern vehicles have become so much more complex, that it's something you get in, you drive, and you take it to a mechanic because you just can't afford or don't have time to build up the experience base to actually be able to work on it yourself.
And buy the tools,
yeah.
And also have the time to know how to use all the tools and the information.
Well, right, because it's not just all about the tools. It's knowing which tool and how to use it and that sort of thing. And how to interpret the data from the diagnostic machine. I mean, it's everybody talks about, you just go down to AutoZone, they'll scan the, pull the codes off when you have the check engine light and they'll tell you what it needs. Well, those guys aren't trained diagnosticians. They're in the business of selling parts. They're going to look at a code and say, oh, it's this part. Well, maybe it's not. And so knowing how to interpret that data and arrive at a proper diagnosis takes a lot of education and experience.
Yeah, and that's the big part of it that comes with the complexities is to be a diagnostician, you have to understand the systems that are interacting, right?
You have to know how they're supposed to work and then in order to analyze how they've stopped working.
Yep. And, I think that is why there's still so much interest in the simpler vehicles because they're pretty, not completely straightforward, but much more straightforward to troubleshoot.
Yeah, when it stops running and you lift the hood, you look down and there's a window in the side of your engine block with a connecting rod hanging out, you know what's wrong.
I think that's a good way to wrap all this up.
Absolutely.
Certainly is not the end of this conversation. This goes on a lot. I'm sure we have these own conversations amongst ourselves in our own club and you know, it happens in LRO. It's an interesting conversation, certainly, and why. But I think if you're going to ask yourself where's the decline happening, you need to categorize it specifically. Because as I said earlier, I don't think there's a declining interest. I think there's a declining interest in certain areas. There's only so much time to, which actually then to sum this all up, that means just listen to the podcast. That's all that means. Right?
Yes, we'll cover all those different social organizations.
We will cover your socialization. We will handle your information sharing. We will handle your collaboration.
Or better yet, listen to the podcast while working on your vintage Land Rover.
And there,
absolutely,
multitasking.
Yes, there are many people. I don't know about many. At least most that I hear from. A lot of times they'll tell me they're listening to the podcast while they're driving their truck or car, or even if they're taking a trip, they're listening while they drive. So shout out to those people.
I'm glad I don't have a commute that long.
I don't think Bluetooth would turn on by the time it takes you to complete your commute.
And my commute is too long for me.
That's true. You could make it shorter, though. You could make it shorter.
Well, actually, it used to be shorter. I used to live on the same compound with my shop. I had a 40-second commute, and that was too long.
You haven't graduated to the cot in the shop yet?
Actually, I have options for napping at the shop, but my body is getting to the age where it doesn't let me do that for very, very long.
Got to get out and see some sunshine anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
Sunshine's overrated.
that's it for what's happening to declining numbers and the news for this month. So thanks very much for listening to the show. We will be back in just a few moments to talk to Martin Port, who is the art editor of Classic and Sport Car magazine out of the UK. He recently attended the grand opening of Jaguar Land Rover's Classics Works facility about a month ago in New York. Welcome back to the Sinister Podcast. This is show number 52 for July 2017, and I welcome our guest this month, Martin Port, who has been on the show before, of Trans Africa fame. I think that's what we call that now. Is it Trans Africa? Did you give the truck a name yet, Martin?
No, it still doesn't have a name. Yeah. I do refer to it as the Trans Africa Land Rover more than anything. So yeah,
I'm suggesting you call it Philip in honor of the previous owner.
That is what we discussed last time, I believe, but it hasn't caught on yet, not with myself, but probably because I completely forgot about it.
I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah.
How's Philip doing? Taking Philip today.
Yeah. Philip's not doing too badly.
That's good. Oh, there we go. That's wonderful to hear. Yeah, you've had some really nice photos that you've been posting the last couple of weeks of it out and about doing important things for important people, right?
And, yeah, it's been very busy. It's been all over the UK.
And you also have a shirt now in honor and I guess in support of the Trans Africa truck. Is that correct?
Yeah. I kind of looked at other Land Rover T-shirts and none of them were quite right. So I thought I'd just be very self-indulgent and do my own. And it seems to have caught on. And so far we've sold probably about 40 around the world. So.
I'm waiting
There'll
for
be
mine.
People in various different continents wearing my little T-shirts, which is quite good.
And how?
It's a good start.
How can one get a hold of one?
Well, if you pop along to our website, which is transafricalandrover.co.uk, there's a handy little button that you can immediately part with your hard-earned money. And they are 20 English pounds, including postage.
P&P, as I've learned.
The P&P, yes, or shipping, or whatever you want to call it.
We call it S&H here, shipping and handling. You've P&P, post and packaging.
Postage and packing.
Packing.
Yeah.
See, we strive to teach and learn here.
It's the price of a stamp and an envelope.
Perfect. Well, that makes sense. So, yeah. So, if you want to help Martin keep Philip the Trans Africa truck, I'm trying on this Martin on the road. Go ahead out to the website Trans Africa. I forgot the website already.
TransAfricaLandRover.co.uk
and pick up a shirt for a mere 20 pounds.
Yeah, absolutely, bargain.
If he renames the truck Philip, you have to change the name of that website.
I'll register multiple domains. Philip.
plus, there would be that awkward there'd be an awkward conversation when Philip starts leaking from his rear end.
Philip is often moist around the back end at the moment, but that is down to nothing more than a leaky oil seal and the diff.
Tell us something that's not new. Yeah.
There is a word for Land Rovers that don't leak.
Empty.
Empty, correct.
Yeah. Two words, non-functional.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's still functional for a little while.
Just noisy.
You can drive it, you just may not make it home.
True. So, Martin, you were one of the select individuals invited to the opening of the Jaguar Land Rover Classic Works facility just this past month in June. So tell us about the Classic Works facility.
It's very impressive. I mean, basically, as far as Jaguar Land Rover are concerned, it brings together multiple parts of their organization into one building, which is just outside of Coventry. And it's an impressive, if incongruous setting, really. It looks nothing more than an industrial building on an out of town estate, but it's very impressive inside with I suppose modern facilities, but only as modern as they need to be. There's nothing like the production line facilities of their main Solihull factory. And this is a premise which is devoted solely, really, to the restoration and maintenance of classic Jaguar and Land Rover vehicles.
Is the facility as cavernous as it looks like in the pictures?
Yes, it certainly is. Yeah, I mean they're going to take a lot to fill it, to be honest with you.
You'd be surprised how quickly that can happen.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the rear of the facility is what they call their collection room, and that is I think it's got housing for 700 vehicles, which there are about 400 in there at the moment, and that alone is a treasure trove of vehicles that they use on museum sites and for classic driving experiences, and also they house candidates for their rebuild program and their reborn programs for the Land Rovers and the Jaguars.
But that's all corporate owned collection there.
Yeah, I mean it's stuff which is owned by them or been bought by them, bearing in mind that over the last few years they've bought a few collections, private collections, that have been up for sale and have marks that they're interested in. So they brought those in-house and are kind of working on those and turning them into experience vehicles and then redistributing them as well through through their other outlets, their other museums and heritage experiences and what have you.
Now, is the reborn program going to be taken at that facility, or are they still doing that over in Solihull?
No, it's all moved there. So the reborn program has moved completely into that building.
Okay.
Along with the Jaguar XKSS and E-Type lightweight continuation program. So basically picking up on the handful of chassis numbers which were allocated back in the 50s and 60s.
Right. The nine they never built.
That's exactly it. So
I think they sold out in 2 days or something crazy like that.
Oh, I mean everything's sold out very quickly. I mean even just on the Series 1 Reborn program, they sold, I think it was all 60 candidates in something like 24 hours. So it's no different on the XKSS and the lightweight program either.
Well, if you think about it, really, it was a bargain. You got a factory-built example for $1.2 million U.S. dollars, which is, 5% of what it costs to buy one used.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a unique opportunity if you were lucky enough to get in there quickly.
Yeah, very quickly with cash in hand.
Absolutely, yeah. But the facility also, as well as the Series 1 Reborn program, it is housing the new Range Rover Classic Reborn program as well. So that's running alongside the Series 1s.
Now, are they also doing restorations for hire?
They are doing a number of different avenues for what they're producing. Let's put it that way. Okay. They are restoring vehicles, obviously, to sell the classic Range Rovers and the Series Ones, but also right. what they're doing, they have quite a number of collection vehicles, and they are putting them out there as vehicles for hire, but in terms of an experience day. And if you want to do an on-road experience day, you hop in one of their E-types, for instance, and you would take it to the Myra test track, and you'd have a day with it there. So they're pitching it as the opportunity to experience it without the financial restraints and pressures of ownership.
Okay. That's to their collection with vehicles they own, though, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Are they going to do restorations for citizens that bring in their vehicle and hire them?
They are opening the workshops in terms of if you wanted to bring your vehicle along and have it restored, then yeah, that is exactly what they're offering as well.
Excellent. Neat opportunity, I think, for a lot of people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's great. I mean, I think I'm not sure how this translates into US dollars, but I mean, their hourly rate is about £120. So it's on the steep side, but it's a unique opportunity and facility to have your vehicle restored or maintained or serviced by the people who built it.
Really, given their skill level, that's not unreasonable.
No, absolutely. And the other thing that they're very, very keen on promoting is that although for some years they've been supplying classic parts, in recent memory, it's a side of the business which has not been pushed and has kind of diminished, really. And that is something which they're now very keen to turn round. And they have invested a lot of money in soft tooling in order to remanufacture parts that to put back into the marketplace for owners. Yeah. So of course they're going to come at a little bit of a premium price compared to some other outlets. But again, you would presume that you're paying for quality.
Well, one would hope, and if that's the case, then it's usually worth the premium price.
That's actually a very reasonable cost.
Those parts to use on their own restorations. They're not going to scrimp and produce something substandard.
And actually, the cost, when you convert it to dollars, would be about $155 US.
Right.
That's actually very good, considering about 5 years ago when I had to go to the local dealer here in the Pittsburgh area, Land Rover charged $95 an hour charged $95 an hour for a service technician. So that even if
I think it's
up,
a little higher than that now, but sure. But also consider that the factory or the Classic Works, which is as close as you get to a factory on something like this, is going to have far more experience than the local dealers will.
Oh yeah, absolutely,
and more capability as well,
and more capability, and the access, is going to be unprecedented to original factory information and tooling, and the other thing, of course, is that a lot of the people that are working in this facility have been handpicked, and are sometimes fourth or even fifth generation Land Rover employees.
Right, so, best of the best.
There is a real passion and heritage, I suppose, that runs through the people who work there as well as everything else, and as well as the vehicles.
Right, and if you're talking about an investment grade vehicle, which I mean some of the people would have, that's really money well spent, because that will reflect in the resale value to have had it restored at the factory or factory level.
Absolutely, yeah.
What you don't know, Martin, is Harold's first love before Land Rovers was Jaguar. So that's why he was very excited to hear about the XKSS.
It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal vehicle no matter what. And, of course, the Steve McQueen connection, too, is
I will be honest. I mean, the first time I was given the opportunity to drive an XKSS was a big box to tick.
Sure, of course.
I now officially hate you.
I drove, yeah, it was a few years ago now, actually, but I drove Jaguar Land Rover's own XKSS, actually, the one that they had on their fleet there, on a private track, which was, it was a great experience.
did they rein you in or did they let you go for it?
No, you just handed over the keys and told to get off it. The life of a journalist is good, isn't it?
I hate you.
Second only to the experience of driving three Ford GT40s on an airfield.
Ooh. Now that sounds fun too.
Original GT40s or the 2005 remake?
There was the 2005 remake. I drove one of those, four replicas, and three originals. Okay. One race going, two road going. One was the original Ford press vehicle. Actually.
Everybody okay. hates you now.
Yeah.
I'll let you have that one. That one, just to me, isn't as exciting as the XKSS. But that's probably personal taste.
Well, the other thing, if you're into Jaguars, that they had there was they have a particular corner, I suppose, set aside for the XJ220. Oh. I don't know if that gets your heart pumping or not, but... they had, I think I counted something like seven in there when I visited.
Well, that's a significant chunk of the ones. They didn't make that many of them. That's a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, that is quite a lot. But they've just, this will make you glad to be a Land Rover owner, even if you go for the most expensive tires. They've just manufactured or put things into place to manufacture original XJ220 spec tires.
Nice.
And a set of those, let's play a little bit of a guessing game, in pounds is going to be how much?
Now, if you have to ask, you can't afford.
Wait, for the set or for an individual tire?
No, for the set.
Set of four.
Four. Set of four.
Just making sure. Wasn't sure, you know, if there was spares thrown in there. It gives me time to think.
I'm thinking you're probably talking a couple thousand per.
I was going to say 2,500 pounds.
Okay, 4,995 plus VAT.
Whoa!
So plus 20% on top of that.
So by the time you convert to US dollars, I'm thinking, yeah, 2,000 per tire is about right.
Right. So yeah, that put my Avon traction mileage investment into perspective.
Well, when Lamborghini came out with their SUV back in the 80s, those tires weren't cheap either.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you get custom-made tires that are purpose-made for a specific high-end vehicle. Every part on it is going to be expensive.
Well, their argument is that they were experiencing vehicles coming back to them, which had, you know, obviously the XJ220, it's a 220-mile-an-hour car. And
actually, 241, if you want
to
be specific.
Well, okay, there you go. they were coming in with original tires. And that's not something you really want.
Oh, not at 240 miles an hour. You want new rubber and good stuff.
Yeah. So I can't remember the manufacturer, whether it was Pirelli or someone like that they've done it with, but they've remanufactured the original spec tires.
Nice.
And that's $6,500 in U.S. dollars is what that converts to.
Yeah. Got to say, I like the XJ220. It's kind of a shame it wasn't allowed to be what it was supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, with half the engine it was designed for, it still was the fastest production vehicle on the planet for decades, if you rule out the McLaren F1, which technically didn't have a dealer network. So if you want to play the game and argue, and McLaren only beat it by 2 miles an hour.
But
the Jaguar was available from your local dealer, so that's a production vehicle.
It's an interesting game of top trumps to play.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mind you, I like the McLaren too. I like everything about it, but the 220 is cool. And if they'd been allowed to build that big V12 they were planning, oh,
might have changed the handling somewhat, didn't I?
Well, yeah, but you know, if you want to talk top speed, I mean, I think the Veyron might have had trouble beating it.
Well, yeah, that's very true. That is very true indeed.
Yeah, I think they had that one of those 220s at Gaydon, didn't they, at the British Motor Museum? I think there's one there, a 220.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
I wonder if they – is that one on loan from Jaguar?
Yeah, Jaguar housed quite a lot of stuff at Gaydon as well, so it's all linked.
Fairly large facility. They have dedicated staff and employees, and there's the rear intake area that you said holds about 750 cars or could. And then what happens after that? Like, from the pictures we've seen more space. That's why I ask.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have. I suppose it is for argument's sake an open plan workshop with areas divided up, you know, for particular areas of expertise. I mean, the series Land Rovers have their own area, but when they do move around the factory, I suppose factory seems a bit crass. It's not a factory as such, it's a facility. When a Series 1 comes into the building and it starts to be dismantled, the interesting thing is that all of the bits which get taken off move around with it. So there is this retains its identity and all the parts that go on there, which is a little bit mind blowing if you think about when you even dismantle a vehicle in your own workshop. The chances are you'll put a load of nuts and bolts down and you won't be able to find half of them. But they try and
tell me about it.
Yeah, there you go. So they try and catalogue every single nut and bolt because they really are putting a lot of effort into reusing every single fixing and fitting and minute part that came off that vehicle.
So it's fabric.
I'd really like to see the logistics.
And goes back on. Yeah,
I'd love to see the logistics of how they do that. That because as a restoration guy, I deal with that problem every day.
Well, let's not be. Again, let's not beat around the bush. They are, even though it's dealing with old vehicles, they are undoubtedly using the technology that has been honed through the production of their modern range or the Discoveries and Velars and what have you into this facility. But it is very much a hands-on, a personable experience rather than there's not a robot in sight, but behind the scenes there's a lot of technology, which no doubt is helping to keep everything together and keep it all working.
And I could see where that would help logistically, but yeah, you're right. I mean, a vehicle was built by hand. You can't exactly restore it with robots.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, they are bringing staff, they're recruiting staff in for specific purposes. In fact, I know a chap who's just joined effectively in the stores because there's experience of parts and extra equipment and optional, extras and optional equipment that was offered in period is, so vast. They didn't have anyone like that. So they've been bringing those people in. So in a way if their knowledge is falling short, they are recruiting from our own network, from our hobby, from our scene, from the specialists that have, kept us ticking along for all these years, which I think is great.
Yeah, it is great.
It's impressive. And I suspect it's not just one, technician, mechanic working your vehicle. I'm sure they've got a number of them involved and even interns, the tagging and keeping things together.
One would hope, however, that they would assign one person to oversee your vehicle, whether they've got multiple staff working on it or not.
That's a good point.
Yeah, they do have an obvious hierarchy in terms of, somebody overseeing the whole lot. And I guess, as you say, people being allocated further down the line to take control of each individual vehicle as they pass through.
So I think that somebody has to be accountable, and I think that, to keep quality, you kind of have to put one person in charge of all the details.
Yeah, no doubt.
So the vehicle comes in, it's disassembled, and does it go into sort of a conveyor belt system then, where the vehicle's assembled and it goes all the way through the different stages of restoration? And
yes, in terms that there are different I suppose bays, and those bays are nothing more than strips of white tape or white lines painted on the floor in some instances, but it does help to move it on to the next stage. There is an area at the back of the workshop where the vehicles come in, they're assessed, they're stripped down, and then they make their way through the facility. I suppose, being restored and then built back up again. The interesting thing is, while I was there, there were two vehicles which were, I think, something like six apart on the production line when they were built. This is series ones. They, by pure accident, found themselves being assembled, reassembled, shall we say, right next to each other on the new production line.
You sure you wouldn't want to hold one of them back five so they'd be six apart on the...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, unfortunately, they're not working in such big quantities to be able to do that at the moment. But,
So they come through, and then my follow-up question to that is everything they're doing on site specifically, do they have fabrication? Do they have paint? Parts, I assume, is anything sent out of the facility, or is everything done there?
They are working pretty hard to bring a lot of it in-house. I think there are still some specialized services, shall we say, which is going out. I know that when I was visiting the Reborn program a year or so ago, 2 years ago maybe, whenever it started, that they were sending out for really specialist things like the sherrodizing, re-sherrodizing, nuts and bolts. But I think even that is something which they either have managed or they are going to be bringing in-house, to the best of my understanding.
It's actually a much more complicated process than just manufacturing a vehicle at a conventional factory, because first you must unmanufacture the vehicle. Mm-hmm. You have to take it completely apart, and then you have to strip all the parts down and then refinish them and then reassemble. There's a lot more involved. It takes a bigger facility to do a restoration.
It does. And the other thing to note is that they are paying deliberate attention to geographical differences. And what I mean by that is, if you've got a vehicle which was sent out to Australia as a knockdown kit, sometimes it would be reassembled there with slightly different rivets than it would have been if it had been assembled in the factory at Solihull.
Right.
And instead of just having a one size fits all process of reassembly, they're saying, okay, well, it was put together originally with those rivets. We're going to put it back together with those rivets now. They are really paying a lot of attention into reproducing that particular vehicle rather than let's just do a batch of series ones.
They're going to put the rivet counters out of business.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Takes it to a new level.
Oh, God, yes.
So this sounds like a full, complete restoration. Is that done for every vehicle? And then my follow-on question to that is, is every vehicle stripped down completely? Or can you bring it in and say, I just want this wing fixed, or maybe I want the axles done, as an example? And then if it is completely stripped down, do they galvanize the chassis?
Very good question. I believe not, in terms of their standard restorations. It's very difficult because at the moment, as somebody who's outside of it, there are blurred lines, if you like, between the Reborn program and what they will or are offering, a walk-in customer. Mm. So I guess that if you ask them to specifically do a strip down and galvanize the chassis, then fine, they would. On the Reborn vehicles, they wouldn't.
Right, because, it's not original.
No, exactly. And the minimum specification for their Reborn candidates is to have an original chassis, an original bulkhead, and those all get repaired. Nothing is replaced in terms of that. If they've, it needs to have hopefully a period correct engine close, numbered pretty closely, if not the original one. They're paying a lot of attention to that. So, but to go back to the original question, I guess if you walked in off the street and you asked them to restore your vehicle, then yes, you could dictate to them whether they did it or not. I don't know. But they are offering maintenance and servicing. That's what the XJ220s were in. A lot of them were just in for servicing and repairs. When I was there, there was a I think a carrel wagon on a conversion on a Series 2, which was there for certainly not a full restoration. It was there for some maintenance, you know. So, yeah, think of it as a slightly more expensive but unique option to your local garage, I suppose.
Wow. It's impressive no matter what they're doing. It certainly is impressive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So on the Reborn, just if I can ask some specific question there, are they saving the nuts and the bolts and cleaning them up, or are they?
Are they
finding like modern versions of the same rivet, for example?
They are. Well, I don't know whether they can reuse the rivets, but in terms of the nuts and bolts, they are most definitely reusing the nuts and bolts that came off that vehicle where at all possible. Obviously, it's not always going to be possible,
right.
Rather than just have a big vat of suddenly, you know, metric nuts and bolts, they're trying to keep everything.
So the Reborn
vehicle. So.
The Reborn sounds like for very specific select set of vehicles, and they're just a handful. They would have to have either a special history to them, or they would have to be in such a condition that a full restoration would not be, you know, rebuilding it for, you know, what if the bulkhead is half gone? You know, does that push it into Reborn, or does that push it to the non-Reborn program, and then it's, you know, they won't follow everything according to the original manufacturer?
Well, I think there is always going to be a percentage argument, if you like, how much new metal can you let into a bulkhead before it you can't class it as the original bulkhead. But I think that most candidates need to be salvageable. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say that certain key components need to be repairable in order to be a candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the word candidate, by the way. I think that seems appropriate. Yeah. A candidate, yeah.
Now, assuming they do this, and if they're doing repairs to the chassis, if they repair and or replace the front frame horn, are they stamping the VIN back in and making it look original?
That is something which I don't know, actually. Very good question. I'll ask them next time I'm there.
We've stumped the Martin.
Because I would think they'd have to have a set of number stamps in the same font and a bottle of whiskey next there so you can get drunk enough to put them in crooked like they were originally.
Absolutely.
Got to be period correct, right?
Yeah.
You ever run across one where the number's upside down?
No, I haven't actually.
I have once.
Wow.
That was a lot of whiskey.
Yes.
Yeah.
How long does it take? I realize everyone's different, and yes, different times, but is there a timeline for them? Are they looking to do, let's say, for the Reborn program, turn it around in 6 months, or they don't put a date on it? Like, you know, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I can't remember specifically, but I mean, they're into, you know, single figures each year. Now, let me just have a look. I mean, I've got written down here, actually, I'm on an E-type here, 6 to 9 months to restore, and that's not the one. I'm just frantically going through notes here.
No, I understand.
That's useful to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I realize every vehicle has its own special things, but you would think if they're devoting full time to this, or, you know, to one vehicle, or is it we work on it once a day per week, and then we move to a different vehicle? How many people, not just guys, but do they have?
Seem to be a pretty full on and constant process. I don't think from the conversations that I had with them, it's not that sort of outfit in terms of. You know, they're not doing a little bit here and there and going off to tinker with something else. It's a devoted process.
I think that they, in order to maximize their resources, they have to keep going once they start.
Absolutely. And the key thing that they were keen to point out, even when they were at Solihull, was that it was still part of a business. It still had to make money. They're not just doing it, purely out of love. It has to make money. And if it stops making money, then it will no longer be a viable part of the business. But hopefully the signs are good.
Right.
Mind you, it helps that the chairman of the board is a car guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That none of this would have happened if it wasn't for Mr. Tata.
No, absolutely. It's you know, it's the good thing is that the moment you walk through the doors of this fairly inconspicuous building, you are still given the sense of passion that you can get from any of their other sites, not just from the people, but the way that they've, I suppose, you know, fitted them out, decorated them, and the way that you're greeted, and everything is a pride in their heritage and their, you know, and the products that they're making now.
So the vehicle's done, and looks like there's a very nice looking, pristine, spotless showroom, and that's the picture that I think was included in all the information. Is that where they like deliver the vehicle to you?
There is, if you're thinking about the one with kind of a turntable, a dais at the front, then that's the part that you walk in straight out of the car park. You walk into their reception, and they have a turntable for, I suppose, presenting cars on, which is it was quite nice with a glass, big glass window behind it, looking back into the factory. So.
Oh, wow.
That's the clean end of the shop.
Every end of that shop is a clean end.
Well, but there's a dirty end. Whether the building is clean, there's dirty stuff happening.
I'm sure there is, but it's cleaned up pretty quickly.
Well, and that's great. I'm just saying that in a facility, in an operation like this, you've got a dirty end and a clean end. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. We've gone full circle. Dirty ends. We've gone back to Philip and his
back to Philip again.
His oily rear diff.
Does that mean we have to call that end of their facility, Philip?
I think this has gotten out of control.
Hey, you started it, buddy.
I was saying that the vehicle that he should, if you're going to name that truck, Philip was an appropriate name. You guys went completely on direction all on your own.
Now, the good thing is, as a possible end note to this, if you're one of the masses that can't afford to go and take your Land Rover there for servicing or to go and buy one that's reborn, you can pay for a tour of the Classic Works facility.
Ooh.
Very reasonable, £49 per person, which is several hours spent in heaven.
Wow, that would actually be pretty cool.
So that's one to earmark for when you're next over in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whole lot of look, but don't touch.
Yeah. Yeah. So the vehicles are, so you can take a vehicle, potentially have it reborn for you, your own, but it sounds like they're selecting vehicles and then they're going to sell them to the public once that's restoration's complete?
Yeah. But, well, I mean, they're all of the 25 initial series ones, like I say, were sold in a matter of hours, and they're still kind of plowing their way through those, but buying more and more in and putting them in that very large room at the back in anticipation of more people coming along and wanting them. And there's no sign of you know, them being sat around for a long time once restored. They're all going to be snapped up pretty quickly, I think.
No, I agree. I completely agree.
I think the people that missed the boat on the first 25 are lining up for the next batch.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Do they have a sense of what they're charging?
The first ones went out for, it's either 60 or 70,000 UK pounds. And the Range Rover Classics, I think, were 130,000.
Wow.
Now those Series 1s, when they're completed with the reborn program, would they then be titled as a 1956 or as a 2017?
No, it's just a restored 1948 80-inch.
Okay, well, in that case, then we could get them here.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. Get your name in quick.
Because the thing is, I mean, no matter what happens over there, the coolest stuff we have a hard time getting because our government won't let us have them.
The thing to do is to move to the UK.
Well, that's an alternative. You guys hiring?
There you go, Harold. You can work at the factory. I think you'd enjoy that.
I might. Yeah.
What other interesting vehicles were there besides Series 1s? There was, you said, Range Rover Classics, XJ220s. Any other interesting things that caught your attention?
Oh, there was a fantastic E-Type, an early flat floor E-Type that was, they'd found it in Arkansas, and it still had all the original paint on it. So it's that, it was white, but it was kind of crazed. It was fantastic. Old cracked white wall tires as well. But unfortunately, it's a candidate for going into their restoration program. So all that would be lost. So it depends on, you know, on what you want really, but I would have just taken it as it was then.
Right. Yeah. Maybe some fresh tires.
Yeah. Maybe. I live dangerously.
Interesting. I don't know if you're aware, maybe we've talked about this, you know, and our listeners have heard about this a lot. Pittsburgh has the Vintage Grand Prix, which is coming up very shortly in a couple weeks. And by the time you hear this, it may have already happened. But they have British Car Day, and it's amazing to me all the vehicles that come out. It's an International Car Day, really. It's just Car Day, but they do the British section. And every year there's got to be a dozen, no, maybe more, two dozen, maybe, Harold, E-types.
There's a number of them.
A sizable number roll out, you know, for that event. I wonder if there's representatives coming to come and go to car shows like this and check them out.
Yeah, well, buying them up and taking them back.
Yep. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Well, that would be a good place for them to go. I mean,
well, absolutely. I mean, on the Series 1 front, they were finding a lot of vehicles in Australia. And shipping them back. I think that's kind of dried up a little bit. And now we're seeing a lot of vehicles come into the facility from France and other parts of Europe. But, yeah, a lot of good, solid vehicles coming over from Australia that they've been buying up.
Well, they don't have a lot of salt on the roads in Australia.
No, absolutely. No,
yeah, I don't think so. That's probably just spray from the ocean, if anything. That would be about it. Don't get too close to the edge. Right.
Right.
Jag E-Type, anything else? Any interesting Land Rovers?
Crikey. Well, yeah, lots of interesting Land Rovers. I mean, there was I think it's a 107-inch in kind of pickup form that was an Australian vehicle, which had a great big, I suppose, kangaroo bars fitted to the front and an upside-down Land Rover badge on the grill. That, again, was a great one for, in terms of patina, I would have just taken it as it was. But next to that was a two-door Range Rover, which was intended as a restoration candidate by the owner, but never got around to it. So it sat underneath a tree for 25 years.
Ooh.
And it's probably got more growth on it than most of us have got in our gardens or our backyards. It looked absolutely fantastic, but very, very sorry for itself in the same sentence. But it's apparently it's a very solid candidate for restoration, so that's what's going to be done.
The first car I ever owned was parked under a tree for several years, and the problem with that was the leaves sat, you know, collected under the car and collected water, and it rotted the floors and the bottom of the wings. And yeah, I mean, there's like no metal for the last 6 inches of the car.
No, absolutely.
I had no business buying that car, but you know, I was 18. What, you know, what the heck?
Take a risk.
Somehow
I was
wide-eyed
and 18, thought I could do everything. And well, it was a good education for me, got to say.
Yeah, a friend of mine was over in the UK and just sends me a random photo of a Series 2A, from the looks of it, sitting in Devon, just in someone's back garden, covered in, and hadn't, looks like it hadn't moved for about 15, 20 years. And you're like, no, too bad, can't pass that along to Land Rover. Go take a look. You know, it's sitting.
Yeah. I'm still looking for myself. I mean, somebody did mention recently they had their own opinion of it, that it was a shame that all these vehicles were being bought up by Land Rover. But really, is it a shame? Because, okay, it's decreasing my own personal chances of happening across an 80-inch Series 1 behind a hedge somewhere that needs restoring. But it must be a good thing. These aren't vehicles which are being prized out of the hands of tearful owners. They are, you know... I hate to use the word, but they are unloved examples which are going to be returned to the road and put into the hands of new owners. And
I think the word we use is rescue.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Now, are they only doing the 80-inch series ones?
They are to start with, but the thing is, this whole process is going to be fairly organic, I understand. I mean, they are, and that's what this facility is going to be able to offer. There is no doubt that given time, they will be moving into the Series 2 market as well. If they're already doing the Range Rover Classics, then, you know, they're going to be filling the gap between the Series 1 80-inch and that. So I don't think we're going to see them restoring Series 3s just yet, but there will come a time when the Series 2 and the later series, the series, you know, 86 and 88-inch Series 1s are going to move into the Series 2s as well, because they're going to run out of vehicles and they're going to have people who specifically want to buy those examples. So
right, that was really my question, is whether they were doing 86 and 88-inch Series 1s as well, or just sticking with the original 80-inch.
In terms of the Reborn, it's just the 80-inch, as I understand it at the moment.
Interesting.
But that, you know, that I think is just based on the, I suppose, the ideal, you know, vehicle in terms of what they were going to kick off the Reborn program with.
Well, and they are just different enough from the others that I guess it makes sense to stick with the one thing until you get everything sorted out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And don't forget, they're coming up with releasing the new Defender, and I think having some examples of the very first original Land Rovers, I think is going to go, they're going to do great marketing, as they always do. And having the, having those old examples ready to rock and roll and then already reborn and restored, so you can compare it to the new, because they like doing that. I think that,
and it doesn't hurt that these Reborn Series 1s cost more than the new Defender when it comes out.
That's true.
This Reborn truck isn't quite what you want, and it's a lot of money. Here, get this one that's got all the new bells and whistles, and it's cheaper.
Right. That's true. Yes.
I'll have one of each.
Exactly.
Well, see, now there you go.
But in all seriousness, that is what they discovered was happening sometimes. You know, some of their clientele moved in that, I suppose, section of society where they were turning up to buy a vehicle and said, oh, actually, I'll have that one and I'll have one of those, and you may as well throw me a restored Series 1 in as well, you know.
Well, yeah, it really is hard to have just one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Got to have a backup or several.
From a fleet management standpoint, it makes a sense to have several, because that way your chances are better that at least one of them is going to run.
Yeah, works for me.
That's how I justify it.
They describe it, Tim Hanick, who's the Land Rover Classic director. He calls it it's not him at all. It's John Edwards, who's the Special Operations Managing Director, calls it the Dream Factory, a place where dreams are made and realized.
I like that.
Very nice.
I think they should have had Her Majesty come out for the grand opening, though. I mean, that would have been so cool. Let her swing a spanner or two.
Well, if nothing else, the royal crests are there in the foyer of the factory. So,
of course, she'd be likely just to jump in something and drive off too.
And who would stop her?
I wouldn't, even if she wasn't the queen. That's just cool. So, you know, little old lady jumps in something and goes for a drive. Yeah, go for it.
The only person in the UK that does not need nor requires a driver's license.
Yep.
Yeah, who's going to write her a ticket for driving without a license?
They can't. They can't.
Exactly.
Martin, thanks very much for coming on and telling us about the
Classic Works.
There we go, the Classic Works facility. I want to call it Heritage. I don't know why, but the Classic Works facility. What are you working on? We need to have you back on the show soon to talk more about what I'm calling Philip and the Trans-Africa truck.
Am I working on?
But what are you working on?
Well, I'm giving it a little bit of rest at the moment, actually. It's been so busy lately. It's been here, there, and everywhere. So, crikey, what am I doing? We're in the very early throes of still planning our African return. put it that way. So we're thinking, if all goes to plan, we're going to take it back to North Africa, a little sortie into Morocco next year, and then try and organize something for further down, deeper down into the country, maybe the year after that.
Like recreating Philip's original trail?
Yeah, to a certain extent. There are parts which are closed for business, as it were, and some parts which are opening back up in terms of the accessibility. So it won't be, you know, verbatim, but it'll be roughly following some of his route.
You're going to go on your own, or are you taking
we're going to go as a family. He did it on his own. We'll be four up.
Wow, it's the Bells 2.0.
It'd be slower.
Yeah, or maybe the Bells 0.5, because you're really, you know, they have a D-130. You're taking a Series 2A, right?
Yeah.
I think of it as more like half the Oxford-Cambridge.
Yeah, well, we're closer to Oxford, so we'll go as Oxford.
All right. Does that mean your jerry cans are whiskey and tonic, or I can't remember whose were whose.
Crikey, I'd have to look. I'm frantically looking for the book that's not to hand. My signed book. By Tim Slessor, let's put it that way. I don't know. No, I'm not a gin or a tonic, so I'll have to go for water or maybe a real ale or a cider. Am I allowed to put that on the front? I don't know.
Sure,
it's your truck. You can put whatever you want.
Exactly. whatever gets you going. Yeah, mine would be beer. I mean, that's just I'm a beer guy. So
yeah, yours would be actually have beer in it.
It would have double IPA, preferably.
Actually, we could build you some bumper mounted keg racks.
I'm liking this idea.
For those little miniature kegs.
That could happen.
I thought you might.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that'd be cool.
Sounds like a marketable option.
There are Land Rovers that people have turned into coffee stands, mobile coffee stands, and pizza ovens.
There's also a bar in Alabama where they actually sawed the right hand side of a 109 body and put it behind the bar.
So why not have dispense beer?
So it sticks out the wall, and then they put all their bottles on top of the wings.
We have plenty of Land Rovers that have been turned into coffee trucks here.
Well, Martin, thanks very much for coming on the show, and we will have you back soon because you have more tales to tell us of Philip and the Trans-Africa truck. And, of course, we want to know what your plans are with it and follow that as you journey back into Africa.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's been fun.
And that's the Center Steer podcast for July 2017. I want to thank our contributors this month. First, Harold, listening to us, talking to us on via Skype.
No, we're all talking via Skype today, I think, aren't we?
That's true.
Well, we are.
Yeah, well, I guess technically I'm not. I'm in the studio with a microphone.
Technically, you've got an open Skype connection to us. So.
Indeed, I do. Thanks for joining us today, Harold. And
yeah, sure. 10 bucks is 10 bucks.
What? There, no, you're paying me. Is that what you're saying? There's no money is changing.
That's what it costs me to show up. Yes.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
Actually, if you really want to factor in lost revenue, it's far more than that. But
it is a Sunday. It's supposed to be your day off.
Am I what?
And also, thanks to Morgan, who is the owner, proprietor, manager of SeriousParts.com.
Thank you for having me.
And now the proud owner of a Nissan Pathfinder.
Yeah, thanks for letting me stay, regardless of.
I think so.
My expansion out of British vehicles.
Well, if you'd bought British something that was, if you'd bought something in good condition that was completely reliable, we'd have to outcast you. But you've bought one that's trying to be British, so we'll let you pass.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you a secret. It's a California vehicle, so it's actually in pretty damn good condition, considering it's, 24 years old or something at this point?
Give it a week or two.
Yeah, all the rubber needs to be replaced. So,
give it a winter.
It's soon as going to be leaking like a Land Rover.
And you still have a Series truck that you still own, so that you're still in the family.
Yeah, and it's non-running, so, you know.
It fits.
Hopefully that helps.
As the best ones are.
So what you're saying is you have declining numbers in your Land Rover fleet?
I do.
Sorry, throwing back to our previous conversations.
Well, not yet, actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah, true.
Oh, that's
not
true.
Yet,
yeah,
the, but you know,
disco is for sale.
You know, it's just dilution because now I have yet another vehicle.
Correct.
That's true. Are you part of the four car club
right now? Yes, personally I am.
Oh, you have more than me. Good.
Look at I want to get rid of a bunch of them.
I call that
two
a good start.
Yeah,
that's a good start.
Well, there we go. If anybody's listening to the podcast and would like a D2 Morgan
or a Volvo 850,
oh,
you know, let me know.
A Volvo 850. Okay, they're available in Vermont. Also, thanks to the One True PAX for production support. What you may not know is that PAX and I recently met for a beer. He was in State College for an event, and I don't live too far away, 2 hours away from State College. So I went up and met him, and that was nice. Just
did he make you sit silently for 10 seconds before you could begin drinking?
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. As a matter of fact, I got there first, so yes. As a matter of fact, there was 10 seconds of me waiting for him to show up.
And did he make you sound better?
Ooh. Oh, interesting.
Or drink better.
Or drink better.
Or drink better, yeah.
No, I think I already yeah. I helped him to drink better, so I think it would be a better way to put that. So he thanks PAX for continued helping us out on the show and making it sound better. And it was nice to actually meet him in person. And it sounds like the plane is coming to a full and complete stop. We can get off the plane soon, right? Right, Morgan?
You can unfasten your seatbelts now.
You're free to move about the cabin. I hope you
cannot start smoking yet.
You got to wait till you leave the airport.
Right.
And also thanks to Martin Port for joining us on the show to talk about the Classic Works facility opening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. We will have Martin back on soon to the show to talk more about Land Rovers and how he intersects with them, because he's got lots of stories that we want to hear.
And he'll give me undoubtedly more reasons to hate him.
I hope you enjoyed show number 52 for July. Thank you for listening. A reminder to visit our website for past shows and show notes. You can connect with us on all the social medias, including Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram. However, we have no email distribution list. I hope that's okay.
We need to get a dial-up BBS going.
Ooh.
Yeah, sure. You two do that. You two do that. I'll let you handle the dial-up BBS.
I've got an acoustic coupler around here somewhere.
But you need that special handset phone to couple
in. Oh, yeah, I got them, too. I got rotaries. I got actually more rotaries than push buttons. I've got a rotary wall phone somewhere or another.
The serious drugs of computers.
Because, you know, you got to do it right. You got to have that good old-fashioned Ma Bell rotary dial phone that you can slam down in the acoustic coupler. And it's all about the slam, folks.
And there's another possible show title. It's all about the slam, folks. You can also directly support the show at patreon.com/centersteer in the British spelling. We'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. The next show should be from the road somewhere, someplace. I don't know. Hopefully all goes well with that. And I will be posting things to the feed as I normally have when I finally get on the road. I'll let you know about that. So,
or perhaps it's from the side of the road somewhere, since you shouldn't be podcasting whilst driving.
Absolutely correct. You're right.
Yes. And we probably wouldn't hear you if you did.
Good point. So that's coming up next month. We'll have a regular show later in the month, and then I plan to have on-the-road segments, for lack of a better phrase, right now. We'll see how that works out. So until then, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by.
Montezemolo?